Reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Greetings, I'm Maimuna Youssef, and this is WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, August 8th, 2025. And we're also in the middle of WPFW's Summer Pledge Drive right now, which gives you the opportunity to support the Latino Media Collective right now by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so as a means to support independent journalism in these times under creeping authoritarianism. And so once again, this is Oscar Fernandez. And today on the show, we put the spotlight on Colombia and the importance of both President Gustavo Petro's challenges to Israeli impunity and the grassroots movement that keeps Petro in check. And in order to do so, we're joined for the first time today by Abigail Cret, who's an artist and writer living in Colombia, whose work focuses on the history of left-wing movements in the 20th century. She joins us today from Bogota, Colombia. Welcome to the show, Abigail Cret.
Hi, thank you for having us on.
Absolutely. And also joining us is Gabe Levine Dreesen, who's NACLA's web editor and a PhD student in history at New York University. And together with Abigail, they have a recent article in NACLA entitled Colombia Challenges Israeli Impunity from Above and Below. Welcome to the show, Gabe.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. So just to be clear, the movement to resist or block resources to Israel that end up being used in the genocide in Gaza is not exclusive to Colombia or one particular country or one particular region. However, based on this recent article that you wrote for NACLA, can you tell us about the importance of last month's emergency conference by the Hague Group? And perhaps in the process, tell us what is the Hague Group and its importance to this conversation that we're going to have today with regards to Colombia challenging Israel's impunity.
So last month on July 15th and 16th, about 30 countries gathered here in Bogota to discuss efforts to coordinate a challenge to Israeli impunity. And they met under the leadership of Colombia and South Africa. And the Hague Group was formed in January 2025, specifically as a challenge to Israeli impunity and as an effort from countries in the global south to uphold international law. And this group emerged out of the lack of enforcement of the ICC and ICJ rulings that came in 2024, under which all states are obligated to act to prevent and punish genocide.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but in the course of this conference, this relating to Colombia, Petro cited Decree 1047. Could you explain to us what this order means and the importance of it with regards to Israel as far as natural resources going from Colombia to Israel, specifically for the purpose of Israel's military?
Yeah. So the decree that he cited, it was mostly cited in the lead up to the Hague conference. I think there was a an op-ed in The Guardian, I think the week before. And so this decree was passed in the, I think it became official law in August of 2024, but he announced it a bit earlier. And the idea was to make it so that Colombian coal, which is a huge percent of Israel's, meets a huge percent of Israel's energy needs. It was passed by decree in order to make it so that no more Colombian coal would go to fund Israel's genocide. And he drew on this as a model to these other states, because under the banner of the Hague Group, the idea was to move from kind of discourse to concrete multilateral diplomatic action. And he ended up drawing on this as kind of like a model for what other countries should follow, as we'll probably get into the kind of agreements that were signed at the Hague Group between the countries that signed onto it. I believe it was only 12 of 30 who did. Those agreements are actually far short of what that original coal ban went towards cutting as far as the material relationship between Colombia and Israel. But, you know, the main reason that we wrote this article is that the decree that was signed in 2024 actually had pretty major loopholes that made it so that Colombian coal was still able to be exported. But that decree, since it was passed in August of 2024, has been kind of a model for the rest of the world as far as steps that could be taken to, you know, hold Israel accountable for its genocide. And so it looped really well into this Hague conference and made Bogota a very natural place for the conference to be held.
And one of the, I think, important points to add there is that one of the main goals of the Hague Group is to move beyond rhetoric and diplomatic gestures and into the realm of material and concrete efforts. And one of those things is an energy embargo along with arms embargo. And it's very important. You know, we've had almost 2 years now of, and, you know, decades prior of states condemning Israel in international forum and states recognizing Palestinian statehood, but that has not stopped the genocide. And so part of what the Hague Group is trying to do is create a framework for holding Israel accountable under international law, which means that states need to stop providing arms and, as Colombia has made the argument, fuel for the genocide.
And just to step back a little bit, I want to give credit to Abigail here for mentioning South Africa, because as I mentioned before, this movement to challenge Israeli impunity is not exclusive to Colombia or Latin America or the Western Hemisphere alone. So at the beginning of your NACLA article, you cite Nassim Mohammed, a member of Colombia's Palestinian community, with the following, quote, "We're here to denounce the holes in Petro's decree, generate pressure, and demand a complete embargo of coal to Israel," end quote. Could you expand on both Nassim's comments on how your article makes the argument that such measures against Israel, quote, "falls upon activists affiliated with Colombia's BDS movement to pressure the government to enforce its own laws," end quote?
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would say first is that Petro, since the original signing of that decree in, I believe, August of 2024, has been seen by progressives around the world, me very much included, as kind of a, you know, leader in the fight to hold Israel accountable for its genocide. And what has been lost in that story, and what I've been trying to kind of report on whenever I've, you know, been living in Colombia and talking to these kind of BDS activists like Nassim, is that there's always kind of been this suspicion that the decree was not enough. And it was really through reporting from a local outlet called the Borahine. They did this long article about how they basically like asked a government ministry, like, "Can you show us data and statistics on what is going on with the coal exports?" And it became very clear that, like, since that decree in August of 2024, nearly a million tons of coal have left Colombian shores and gone to Israel. And so it put activists like Nassim and other people who are very involved in Colombia's BDS movement in a bit of a weird situation, because obviously Colombia is hosting this international conference and is recognized internationally as a leader when it comes to holding Israel accountable. And Petro is deserving of the praise he has received for his discourse, for cutting diplomatic ties. And we can get into some of the kind of more concrete things he's done as well. But it has become increasingly clear that the way that this decree was crafted was not good enough. And mostly the main hole in the decree that people have cited is that it respected pre-existing contracts. So the two kind of large multinational corporations that have been, you know, mining and exporting coal, Drummond and Glencore, have been able to argue and have said very publicly that what they were doing is legal and that they're respecting the language of the decree. Since Petro and Colombia have hosted the Hague conference, he's really kind of ramped up his rhetoric against making it so that, in his words, not a single ton of coal will leave Colombia and go to Israel. But that, again, has been done by decree in a way that kind of puts activists with Colombia's BDS movement in the role of kind of watchdog. And there's been this kind of longer pattern of these really noble, brave decrees from the Colombian government saying, like, we're going to do this, we're going to hold the Israeli government accountable. And it's fallen to activists in these spaces to hold them accountable. And so I think it's worth saying that for us, what was interesting about writing about the Hague group is while there was a week of events of kind of conferences within the halls of power of diplomats and governments talking amongst themselves, Colombia's very kind of militant, active, and potent BDS movement was putting on kind of a counter-programming that didn't reject what was going on in the halls of power, but really, really called for more. And so the event that I was at, which is where Nassim's quote comes from, it was about making it so that Colombia could move towards a more complete energy and military embargo of Israel. And we can get into what was agreed upon at the Hague group, but there was no discussion at all of the energy embargo, right? And so Colombia is really pushing the envelope further than any other country is doing. We mentioned South Africa. There are other countries who have been very vocal about denouncing what they deem to be a genocide in Israel, you know, but recently unions in Brazil have been calling for Lula to actually cut oil exports. South Africa exports a lot of fuel to Israel as well. And so Colombia has been leading, but also people have been kind of demanding more. And in recent weeks, Petro has kind of turned it up a little bit. But like I said, that quote comes from a recognition of what that step means symbolically to call for that coal embargo, while also realizing that the trade has been going on as more and more Palestinians are dying with fuel from Colombia.
This is what I find about your article very hopeful and fascinating as it pertains to Colombia, because this sort of back and forth between the government right now and these grassroots organizations, chances are they may not have happened in Colombia 5 or 10 years ago, considering the long line of right-wing governments in Colombia for decades, for generations, all under U.S. support. So to see this back and forth is quite impressive, to a certain degree, quite motivating. And I would even argue that even if Gustavo Petro were to be keeping every promise and going by everything that he promised he said he would do with these actions with regards to Israeli impunity, it would still call upon grassroots organizations on Colombia to keep the pressure on him, not just to keep his word, but also to recognize the urgency of the central point that we're discussing here, which is the ongoing genocide in Gaza, which has become a starvation campaign, even as we have this conversation right now. So central in your article is the importance of coal, one of the main resources in question. I find the use of coal a little bit archaic, but I digress here. Colombia's BDS movement even noted coal as an example of whether or not such rhetoric by Petro is actually being put into practice. For example, Maren Mantovani, a member of the International Secretariat of the Palestinian National BDS Committee, said the following, quote, "Colombia as a state is having to fight for sovereignty over its own resources and where they do and do not go," end quote. Could you tell us about who actually controls Colombia's coal mining and how trade deals undermine the validity of the Petro administration's sincerity in challenging the Israeli government?
Just start off by saying that the coal issue is particularly interesting because obviously it links Colombia to the situation in Palestine right now, but then it also on the ground links indigenous movements, environmental movements to these larger international questions. And I think is very important to consider because in the way that it sort of exposes the workings of the international system, both economically and politically. And one of the things that was notable during the week of events was what a nexus this was for social movements, for unions and indigenous organizers and environmental movements who have been on the ground fighting to protect their territory from contamination and from displacement, especially in the north of Colombia. So it's a point that brings together so many questions that are incredibly urgent, both at the national and international level.
Yeah, and I think The issue of kind of trade agreements and the way in which Colombia may or may not have control over its own resources and kind of the kind of sovereignty issue that that quote is referencing, we haven't really like gotten to that point yet. And part of this has to do with the holes in that decree, which Petro is, to his credit, very actively now trying to close. I mean, like I said, there was a new decree that was open for public comment, and now that period of public comment has been closed, and it's expected that that decree will pass within a couple weeks or a month. And that one says very explicitly that, you know, those pre-existing loopholes which respected pre-existing contracts, which is the mechanism through which these coal exports have continued, those will be closed. If that is the case, then we will enter into a situation in which kind of this larger battle over sovereignty becomes really potent, because basically that would mean, and Petro has been very open about this recently, that would mean canceling large multi-year, multi-million dollar concessions that the Colombian government gave to multinational corporations who have been exporting this coal and openly canceling them. We can kind of talk about the way he is arguing that that should be allowed. But when it comes to this larger battle over sovereignty, it's something that a lot of people in the Colombian opposition have been raising, because they say, you know, if you cancel this free trade agreement, nobody wants to invest in Colombia. You know, we're going to be sued. There are so many stories of other Latin American governments, notably in Honduras recently. There was this kind of post-neoliberal turn towards, you know, these are our resources, we're going to fight for them. And Honduras was sued like 10 times in these international courts that just exist so that billionaire investors can like recuperate funds from these projects that are extractive in these other countries. And eventually Honduras just left that court. But all of that is to say that when you take on the power of multinational corporations, which if Petro is earnest in saying no more coal is going to leave Colombian shores to go to Israel, that's kind of the conflict that we're heading towards. So right now there's not really like a real test case that we can point to be like, what does it look like for Colombia to fight for sovereignty over its own resources? Especially because it's very rare for people to make those arguments about sovereignty in a moral lens, which for me is the kind of most exciting way that puts Colombia at the vanguard of all of this, is just saying, we can get into this a little bit later, but saying something along the lines of like, if we enable this coal to continue leaving our shores, we're also violating international law. So it's kind of elevating this moral, but also like deeply rooted claim in international law against free trade agreements, which in the piece we bring up, Marin also mentioned that in some ways these free trade agreements should very deeply be invalidated by the fact that the partner they're trading with is committing a genocide. But we're not yet at the point where this sovereignty battle is so open yet. Hopefully we will get there, and hopefully Colombia will keep pushing the envelope, but it is yet to be seen.
I just want to add there that, as we said, Colombia's we're sort of pushing into new territory here. And part of, you know, this leadership coming from Colombia and coming from the Hague group is in the attempt to hold Israel accountable is also an attempt to salvage international law. Mm-hmm. And an interpretation of international law is made to stick through force and through coercion usually. And we think of that as usually as military power, but Colombia and these other countries are introducing this other possibility to use economic leverage, using trade relations, and in this case, a commodity export ban to do this. And this is very interesting and unprecedented and potentially a model for other resource-rich countries in the South to use. And so I think that's part of, you know, the international law stuff can seem very abstract, especially given that what we've witnessed over the past 22 months. However, I think what the Hague Group represents is an attempt to use these international institutions and multilateralism in a progressive fashion, and to fight to give content to international law, which has often been hollowed out and or, you know, utilized in a hypocritical manner.
Gabe, I want to go back to you in a second to ask you about the 12-point plan that you mentioned earlier that came out of this emergency conference last month. But before I do, as I mentioned at the top of the program, that WPFW is in the middle of its summer play start right now. So if you want to continue to hear thoughtful, independent, critical thinkers like our guest today, and continue to hear compelling stories like what we're discussing right now about Colombia challenging Israeli impunity, we need the support from the audience, financial support from the audience, in order to continue to bring these fantastic guests on the show. So in order to do that, make a donation to the Latino Media Collective and WPFW at this hour. Go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so as a means to support independent media outlets like WPFW in this time of creepy authoritarianism in the United States. Because as we see with corporate media outlets like CNN, for example, they've been in a lot of hot water this week alone over one of their commentators, Scott Jennings, referring to starvation in Gaza as a hoax. This is a paid employee of CNN bringing up straight up lies and something completely counter to everything that we've been discussing with our fantastic guest today. But this is the sort of people that are allowed a platform on CNN and other corporate media outlets like CNN. And so this lends itself again to the importance, not just the importance, but the urgency of supporting independent media outlets so we could continue to have fantastic guests like Abigail and Gabe on the show and fantastic outlets like NACLA on the show as well to give them a platform to give us these compelling, thoughtful, well-researched articles with regards to Colombia. You know, in a more ideal world, the United States would be much more aware of not just what's going on in Colombia, but also recognize how a grassroots movement works in keeping their government in check. And what we're seeing in Colombia is not only astounding, but it's something that, as I said before, could not have happened in a place like Colombia, one of the most, if not the most militarized country in Latin America, 5 or 10 years ago. And I want to go into depth a little bit more about that later on in the program. But again, all these fantastic stories, all these issues, the sense of urgency that we're conveying here, it's only possible if you support independent media outlets like WPFW. So once again, go to WPFWFN.org to make a donation. And you can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. So once again, going back to the conversation here, from this emergency conference last month from the Hague Group, there came a 12-point plan with regards to challenging Israeli impunity, or at the very least, preventing coal from going to Israel. I wonder if you give us a few examples or give us some details to this plan, because I saw it in your article. A lot of it seems like a no-brainer, but then again, it's not, because not enough countries are implementing this or putting this into practice. So please give us some details about it.
So after the conference that took place last month, there was an agreement to 6 points and 12 countries signed on to it. There were 3 points related to preventing the transfer of arms to Israel. So this included preventing docking or servicing of ships or preventing ships from transiting under the flag of countries that have signed on to this agreement. And so that's obviously to prevent the transit of arms, munitions, fuel, military equipment. There was a point about reviewing public contracts in order to prevent public funds from supporting not only the genocide, but also Israel's ongoing illegal occupation. And I think we'll get into that a little bit more, what the stakes of these public contracts are, when we talk a little bit more about the arms embargo. And then there were 2 points regarding compliance with obligations under international law for the investigation and prosecution of crimes, both at the national and international level. And this has specifically to do with support for universal jurisdiction mandates. And last year, the ICC issued arrest warrants for Netanyahu and also the defense minister, Gallant, and for war crimes. And not only have states not complied with their obligations under the Rome Statute, which would be to arrest and turn these war criminals over to The Hague, but they've specifically said that they would not comply in the case of a few European countries. So these were, as you said, these are sort of the bare minimum. These are things that are already required of states under international law. We had 12 states sign on to it here, and then they've left open the deadline till September, and they're hoping more states join before the UN General Assembly meeting. And I think we should just also note that, you know, it's amazing that this multilateral leadership is coming from the global south, but as we know, the arms continue to flow from the United States, China remains a major trading partner with Israel. And, you know, we're hoping, the hope would be more states would sign on to these very basic agreements. But there is this larger question of, you know, these are states, some of the largest contributors to the genocide, obviously, remain completely complicit and are not honoring their obligations under international law.
Precisely. And I would also make the argument here that, you know, to a certain degree, actually to a large degree, it shouldn't come as a surprise, this growing solidarity with Palestine and the situation going on in Gaza. As a matter of fact, NACLA did a whole edition this past winter, earlier this year, dedicated to solidarity movements throughout all of Latin America towards the Palestinian people. We have to remind ourselves in this conversation that one of the largest Palestinian diasporas throughout the world is in Latin America, in places like Brazil, in places like Chile, even in small places like Nicaragua, Honduras, and El Salvador as well. And so this sort of explains, if not at the very least, a very important and crucial frame of reference as to why this solidarity in Latin America is as such for the people of Palestine. And as we said before, it's not exclusive to Colombia or even this conversation that we're having today. So we're going to take a quick break right here. We're speaking with Gabe Levine Dreesen, who's NACLA's web editor and a PhD student in history at New York University, and Abigail Kret, who's an artist and writer living in Colombia, whose work focuses on the history of left-wing movements in the late 20th century. Their recent article in NACLA is entitled "Colombia Challenges Israeli Impunity from Above and Below." This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We just want to remind everyone that we are in the middle of WPFW's Summer Pledge Drive, which gives you the opportunity to support the Latino Media Collective by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
على ديني على أرض تلاقيني أنا لأهلي أنا فديهم أنا دمي فلسطيني 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 أنا دمي فلسطيني
was Mohammed Asaf, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that we are in the middle of WPFW Summer Place Drive, which gives you the opportunity to support the Latino Media Collective by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're talking about Colombia challenges Israeli impunity. We have Gabe Levine Dreesen, who's NACLA's web editor and PhD student in history at New York University, and Abigail Kret, who's an artist and writer living in Colombia, whose work focuses on the history of left-wing movements in the late 20th century. Their recent article in NACLA is entitled "Colombia Challenges Israeli Impunity from Above and Below." So could you guys tell us, going back to the issue of the Palestinian community in Colombia, can you tell us more about this community and Colombia's BDS movement? Because as we see here in the U.S., there's all sorts of legislation in various states of banning BDS in one form or another. In Colombia, it's the opposite. And so it's, in my opinion, worthy of our attention and worthy of our understanding here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's useful to dive into that larger history, because as you mentioned, and I think it's really worth hammering home, you know, Colombia for so long in Latin America was known as the Israel of the region. I mean, that was like an open nickname that people would use. And it had a lot to do with its tight ties to the United States and its kind of like right-wing politics, which was a model for the rest of the region. That history was not always the case. And as you've mentioned about Colombia's large Arab community, Colombia has quite a large Arab community. It's in kind of northern cities. There are a lot of Lebanese Colombians. When I could be mistaken on this, I'm not a historian of Arab migration, but I do recall that for my friends and colleagues who have studied it, when Arabs migrated to Colombia, they were kind of just loosely grouped into the, they were all called Turcos or Turkish people. So they're kind of like the specific kind of example or where they're from is not always super clear. But I would say that, you know, Colombia has quite a large Arab population. I mean, you know, not to use the obvious example, but there's people like Shakira and, you know, there's cities like Barranquilla who have Arab mayors. And it's something that's quite striking. I remember traveling through the Colombian Caribe and, you know, the food that is offered on the side of the road are, it's Middle Eastern food. I mean, it's quite striking. And that history actually does reflect quite openly on kind of some of these larger issues that have to do with the relationship between Colombia and Israel, because I actually got into kind of studying this larger history of Colombia and Israel because I'm, you know, doing archival research on my own project. And I would always see things that had to do with Israel. And it turns out that Colombia was one of the, if not the last country in Latin America, or at least South America, to recognize Israel. And it did so in 1957. And in these kind of government documents where it said, you know, why has it taken so long? They cited their large Arab population. So it said that we think about Colombia as this country that is extremely tightly tied to Israel, but that's not always been the story. Now, when it comes to Colombia's BDS movement, I think, as you've mentioned, a lot of the issues that affect, you know, the way that Colombians feel and can see themselves in kind of the destruction of Gaza does overlap quite well with the rest of Latin America, you know, and a lot of that has to do with U.S. imperial violence, Cold War genocides in the 60s and 70s, and people's long-running memories of kind of counterinsurgent right-wing paramilitary violence that they can quite often easily project onto Israel, not only because the model is so obviously similar, but because Israel was here sowing terror in the region, right? So the kind of deep connection between Colombia and Israel, which within the 21st century is unique in the region to the extent that these countries were so tied. And some of that has to do with the presidency of Álvaro Uribe, famous now for being under house arrest. We get small victories in the world. But Colombia originally kind of got tighter ties to Israel in the late 80s and early 90s. And what was attractive to Colombia, kind of military elites who were locked in a battle with left-wing guerrillas, namely the FARC, but also other groups, what was attractive to them about the Israeli model was the destruction and violence that they had sowed all throughout Central America. I mean, the Israeli army was selling weapons to El Salvador, Nicaragua, and most famously was extremely violent in kind of reorganizing and exterminating much of the countryside of Guatemala. They were also there in Argentina, working with one of the most anti-Semitic governments in all of the region. But all of that to say, that relationship really took off with Colombia in the 1990s. And I think it's really worth kind of diving into, as you had mentioned, what makes it so amazing that Colombia is now leading this struggle for the rest of the world, because these ties were so tight. So in the 1990s, the leading paramilitary group, which would eventually become known as the AUC, segments of which are part of the reason that Uribe is now in jail, because he had kind of deep ties to these right-wing paramilitaries. But one of the founders of that paramilitary group that, again, sowed terror all across the Colombian countryside. They were in the midst of a kind of war with the left-wing guerrillas, but Colombia's state and national commissions and kind of truth commissions have been very open about the fact that these right-wing paramilitary groups committed the vast majority of kind of murder and torture of civilians. The founder of that group went and lived in Israel and was trained there, and Carlos Castaño has openly said that the model of Israel as kind of this like soldier-citizen blend and the way that everybody is so securitized and the way that they treat the Palestinians was the model for how the AUC would kind of seek to sow terror in the Colombian countryside. And Israel did not only host 40 or 50 AUC students in Israel to train them on right-wing paramilitary violence. They also were there on the ground providing them weapons and training them, right? And so these things are not abstract. And the salience with which Colombian progressives and Petro himself, but starting with kind of the BDS movement, the kind of emotional potency of this moment is not hard for people to understand. You know, like, these progressive social activists in Colombia have been targeted by the same type of right-wing paramilitary violence that they can very easily see going on in Gaza. And people have been very open about that parallel. You see people like Petro saying, you know, when he decided to cut ties diplomatically with Israel, he said, we know this is a genocide because we had a genocide, and that genocide was aided and abetted by Israel, right? These stories are really, really real. And I think people very easily like to kind of project onto Petro this like weird fascination, or even going so far as to say it's anti-Semitic. There's this weird focus on Israel, but it's something that's extremely deeply rooted in this country's history of right-wing violence and trauma. And I would say a couple other things that, you know, this idea or this smear that anybody who sympathizes with Palestine, which, you know, as you have two people here who have done a lot of organizing in the United States, this smear that if you are sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, you are in some way a terrorist, really does not work that well in Colombia, for one, because I obviously do not think that he's a terrorist, but you have a president who was a former guerrilla fighter who's been getting this since the day he took power. And for two, people can very deeply see that during the right-wing and Álvaro Uribe-backed government's kind of extermination of both the guerrillas, but also civil society writ large, anybody in large cities who would say, it feels like we're just massacring innocent campesinos, they would be called terrorists, or they would be called terrorist sympathizers. And so you have these amazing tweets of people who are actually involved in Colombia's government saying, you know, substitute the FARC for Hamas and campesinos for Palestinians, and you have the exact same situation. So this kind of like reliance upon anti-Semitism, you're a terrorist, you support, it doesn't work in a context where people have A, dealt with this, and B, where the emotional salience of like what it means to see Israel doing this to somebody is so powerful. Because when you talk to people, they will say, you know, if we can destroy the Israeli model that is oppressing and exterminating Palestinian people, we will also be destroying the same mechanisms of violence that actively are displacing us and doing violence against our communities.
I knew you were the right guys to talk to today for this Place Drive show, because I'm glad that you mentioned Guatemala. We did an entire show on Israel's involvement on the Mayan genocide in Guatemala in the 1980s. And during the course of several shows that we've done in the last year and a half alone, whether it be in Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, you know, there have been passing references to Israeli involvement in some of those wars that took place back in the 1980s. As a matter of fact, as you mentioned earlier, the Arab diaspora in Latin America is very vast. We also did a whole show on the history of the Palestinian diaspora throughout Latin America. It goes all the way back to the late 1800s, before the Nakba, before these chain of events even took place. And because of that, the Palestinian community in particular is very vast, very complicated, and not as black and white as people would think with regards to its community throughout Latin America. It could be as left-wing as former Salvadoran guerrilla fighter Shafiq Hando, who we did an episode on earlier this year, and it could be as right-wing as current authoritarian President Nayib Bukele, also from El Salvador. And so, again, there's a lot of complexities there, but it's a crucial frame of reference, along with the Mayan genocide that you mentioned earlier, as to why Latin American grassroots organizations are in solidarity with people from Palestine, even today, and even years ago as well. So this is not something that sprung up overnight. Now, you mentioned earlier these military ties between Israel and Colombia, and how they've sort of loosened up, but they haven't loosened up altogether. So for example, in 2017, Benjamin Netanyahu became the first Israeli prime minister to visit Latin America. And his first visit was in Colombia, as we mentioned before, one of the most militarized countries in Latin America. Here's a clip from the Associated Press with a few statements made by Netanyahu at a press conference with then Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos about this new special relationship, quote unquote. And again, this was back in 2017. So let's take a listen.
I think that this opportunity to visit Latin America and to visit Colombia, the first visit of a sitting Israeli prime minister, I think is one that infuses us with great excitement, great emotion. We believe that there is great hope. We think that Latin America as a whole has tremendous potential. And we believe that the world is now at the juncture of a great change. The world economy will never be the same again. Everything is becoming technologized, everything. Iran is sending its forces and its terrorist outreaches everywhere, including into Latin America. And we believe that all countries should unite, as Israel is cooperating with Arab countries, to prevent the expansion of Iranian aggression and terror to other continents as well.
So that was Benjamin Netanyahu back in 2017 on his first trip to Colombia, sort of in the second half, as you heard, with the usual fear and racist saber rattling towards Iran and associating it with Latin America. You know, the usual type of rhetoric that we usually hear today, even now. So I play this clip because I think it is a microcosm to what you describe as a tangled and complicated web of Colombian military ties to Israel. Could you give us some more examples on how deep these ties are between the two militaries in your article?
Yeah, I will. Abiga has done a lot more of this research into what's going on today when it comes to weapons. But I'll say that when it comes to getting us from understanding the kind of transition from, you know, the Cold War, where we've talked about these kind of ideological overlaps, to that clip in 2017, a really crucial kind of stop through point is the global war on terror, where Colombia was very successful under Uribe, who was a very close friend of George Bush. He actually, I think, got the Medal of Honor or the Medal of Freedom, or, you know, got crowned with some like horrible genocidal necklace in the White House. But he was a very tight ally of George Bush. And also at that point, I think it's really important to say that like the reliance upon Israeli weapons from the Colombian military is not just your average country looking for weapons to upgrade its systems. It's something extremely ideological in the way that Colombia has positioned itself as fighting its own quote unquote war on terror, right? So when they see kind of rested populations or the guerrilla groups, they don't see a conflict that can be dealt with structurally, or that has to do with land reform, or that has to do with kind of these more holistic ways of solving conflict. What they see in the way that Uribe waged this war was kind of an all-out war on civil society that was very, very deeply influenced by what the United States was doing during the global war on terror. And the United States itself, George Bush at the time, was extremely influenced by Israeli models of kind of counterinsurgency against Palestinian people. And so it's worth emphasizing again that this is not just some, like, you know, a lot of countries buy weapons from Israel, but for Colombia, it was something extremely, extremely ideological when it came to fighting its own war. And Colombia, shockingly, I mean, there's this longer history of kind of its tight ties to U.S. imperialism. It was the only country in the region to send troops to Korea, which is an extremely bizarre history. And Colombia was one of the only countries in the regions who openly backed the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and it stirred a lot of trouble in the region. So these ties are extremely, extremely tight. And when we get to talking about what's going on now, it's important to kind of understand that global war on terror background.
Precisely. This is one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show, because it illuminates so many things that we did not know about the grassroots movements that's taking place, not just in Colombia, but throughout all of Latin America as well. And it's only possible by supporting independent media outlets like WPFW. And this is why we encourage everyone that if you want to continue to hear more fantastic guests like Abigail and Gabe on the show, to hit upon these stories that are of great importance, not just to Latin America, but also Latinos here in the United States, we need your support at this hour. So please go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. I don't know if this was from NACLA or another publication, but I think there are even Colombian soldiers in Ukraine for some reason, sort of as a way to explain or point out the absurdities of how over-militarized Colombia has been for generations now, that soldiers are going to wars that have nothing to do whatsoever with Colombia. And so, again, this brings, as I said earlier, sort of the astonishment that there's this back and forth with grassroots organizations and this current government. Could that happen here in the U.S.? I highly doubt it, but it lends itself at the very least to why we need to have a greater understanding, a thoughtful understanding of what's taking place in Latin America. And it's only possible by supporting independent media outlets like WPFW. So once again, go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. Towards the end of your article, in spite of the shortcomings that we mentioned with regards to the Petro administration, can you tell us how he has engaged with unions and indigenous groups in blocking coal from going to Israel? I'm astounded that the Wayuu tribe, the indigenous Wayuus in Colombia, have listened to a certain degree, correct me if I'm wrong, have listened to a certain degree the call to try to block, you know, any sort of mining that would eventually lead to coal going to Israel. Because much like everything else that we mentioned, the Wayuus have a long contentious history with the Colombian state, particularly with numerous right-wing governments in the past. So to have this sort of interaction is quite interesting. You know, I don't know if, you know, this is an example of sort of, you know, the hopefulness that people see in trying to stop resources from going to Israel. But again, this is one of those things that I drew here that sort of surprised me. Are there other things in the article in the few minutes that we have left that you would like to point out that also deserve our attention here that people should draw as an important lesson from your article?
I just wanted to return. I mean, we spent some time talking about how militarized Colombian society is and sort of the history there. And I just wanted to bring us back to the present to talk a little bit about the arms embargo. And obviously the Hague Group's main priority right now is to stop shipments of arms to Israel. And when we talk about the relationship between Colombia and Israel, we're talking about arms flowing the other way. But it's still very important to talk about this because halting purchases from these Israeli companies is covered under the Hague Group's agreement in terms of public contracts. And this has stirred up a lot of questions here in Colombia because of some of the existing contracts and what has happened since Petro announced that he was suspending arms purchases from Israel. And I think it's an instructive case to see, again, how there can be a decree or sort of this political will. And then when it comes down to the details, things get more complicated. So I just wanted to mention that really quickly. And in terms of the way that this weaves together Israel and Colombian society, again, that these weapons that Colombia has been purchasing are developed and tested in Palestine. And that's part of how they're marketed, that they've been tested on the ground there. And then in 2021, these weapons were turned on protesters here in Colombia. And so that link is really important to understand. And some of these major defense contractors are, in fact, state-owned enterprises. So cutting off commercial ties with them is a very important part of ending complicity in the genocide. And so since Petro announced the suspension of arms purchases, there have been some deals that have still gone through. And so this is another point that the BDS movement here has been pointing to in terms of trying to hold the government accountable. And so we'll continue to kind of see how that unfolds. But these are, you know, deals with companies like Elbit that have been a longstanding target of the BDS movement. And last April, the National Police signed a $200 million contract with Elbit for the maintenance of their surveillance system. So clearly these ties are very deep, and the BDS movement here is doing a lot to try to hold the government accountable and make sure that they are actually severed.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that, you mentioned the case of the YU, and I think oftentimes when we talk about issues of kind of Israel-Palestine, it can come off as, oh, you know, like only super educated or activists or whatever care about those issues. But I think that's always been something that's, you know, been completely proven wrong by the experience of the people that we're talking about here, right? And so when it comes to having like a very material understanding of how these things are, you know, one could say intersectional, people are very understanding of that, right? So when it comes to the case of the YU, you know, their land has been despoiled, their waters poisoned, their community leaders killed. And in a kind of crazy coincidence, there were even kind of like leaked documents at one point that showed that kind of some of the community leaders trying to lead resistance against the mine were being targeted with Israeli spyware. So these things are very, very connected. And so for kind of indigenous groups in Colombia, they didn't even really need to wait for a call from the president. They kind of understood this themselves, and they've been organizing around it for a long time. And a similar thing has to be said when it comes to the role of labor unions, right? And this is something that is, for me, the kind of most inspiring thing when it comes to looking at Latin America, because living in the United States, our labor unions are extremely timid and often just vehicles of one political party, right? And when it came to originally kind of trying to get an arms embargo from the United States to Israel, something that were like extremely timid moments of unions being like, well, we should probably have a ceasefire. Here, there's no holding one's words, right? In November of 2023, the coal workers union, Cintra Carbón, released a statement calling for the government to stop exporting coal to Israel. And they did so not because of some kind of abstract sympathy for the Palestinian plight, but because their union members had been massacred in the 1980s by right-wing paramilitaries trained by Israel, right? So these things are not abstract, and the Colombian model is kind of showing the way forward when it comes to the types of collaborations that can exist between indigenous movements, progressive movements, labor unions, and having somebody in the presidency who cares about these issues. I think that one thing that would be more useful is if there is kind of more collaboration when it comes, you know, like a lot of the kind of decrees that have come from the Colombian government are often kind of just like tweeted out, or they kind of like emerge, and a lot of the activists we talk to kind of either don't really know that they're happening or kind of are unclear about it. And so, like, you know, Petro is clearly, again, I do not want to undercount this, like leading the global South when it comes to how to hold Israel accountable and taking steps that no country in the world has come to take. I mean, when we were at these panels, you know, there was this joke that was being said that, you know, like, at least Colombia has a poorly written decree. You know, like Brazil and South Africa don't even have that, right? And so it is clear that he's trying to make this move from discourse to material action. And I think that one thing that I've been kind of hearing from people involved in this from the beginning is that they don't need to wait around for the government to do something. They're organizing themselves. However, that kind of more organic collaboration would make it so that these things are more deeply enshrined in Colombian law, because hanging behind, you know, the screen of all of this is that in 2026, they have elections and these decrees can be turned over right away, right? So a deeper connection seems to be something that people are asking for, and the groundwork is already laid for that because, as we said, people identify with that cause very deeply.
And one last lesson before we leave that I think was pointed out by labor unions that we should address here before the show ends is that we have to remind ourselves that there are people making money off of genocide right now. Mm-hmm. And grassroots organizations in Colombia are not only recognizing it, but pointing that out. And in your article, you named some companies as well. So with that said, we've been speaking with Gabe Levine Dreesen, who's NACLA's web editor and a PhD student in history at New York University, and Abigail Kret, who's an artist and writer living in Colombia, whose work focuses on the history of left-wing movements in the late 20th century. Their recent article in NACLA is entitled "Colombia Challenges Israeli Impunity from Above and Below." We're going to create a link to this article on our Twitter account. But in the meantime, Abigail, Gabe, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely, no problem. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone again that we are still in the middle of WPFW Summer Place Drive. So go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Israel's Security Cabinet early today approved Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposal for the occupation of Gaza City, which paves the way for a phased military takeover of the already devastated Gaza Strip. Just yesterday, Netanyahu told Fox News he intended to take control of all of Gaza, something long demanded by far-right members of his coalition. Israel has not said when the takeover of Gaza City will begin. Roughly 1 million Palestinians currently reside in Gaza City, and many have already been displaced several times throughout the war. A senior Israeli official said that the plan approved by the cabinet will see those civilians forcibly displaced, what Israel calls evacuated, towards the south. Reaction to the plan for Israeli control of Gaza City is being fiercely challenged within Israel and around the world. Speaking from Geneva today, the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, said, quote, "On all evidence to date, this further escalation will result in more massive force displacement, more killing, more unbearable suffering, senseless destruction, and atrocity crimes," close quote. In other news, as American tariffs fall on countries across the world, some, like India, are pushing back. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
President Trump's broad tariffs went into effect yesterday, with many countries who have reached trade deals with the U.S. quietly accepting the new tariffs. However, some nations were left out in the cold. India and Brazil, both major economies and allies, are now facing 50% tariffs. In the case of India, the world's largest country and democracy, the extreme tariffs have sparked trade conflict. Just today, India canceled several orders of weapons and military vehicles. For months, India and the U.S. seemed on track to make a deal for around 25% tariffs. But just this week, President Trump decided that this was unacceptable and added an additional 25% tariffs to punish India for buying Russian oil. India bought over $52 billion worth of Russian oil last year, majorly strengthening Vladimir Putin's war machine. India's right-wing Prime Minister Modi was completely unapologetic, calling Putin his friend today and emphasizing a closer partnership between India and Russia.
In more news, at the direction of President Trump, federal law enforcement agencies began patrolling Washington, D.C. at 12:01 this morning. The new patrols include agents of the U.S. Capitol Police, the FBI, and 12 other agencies. The federal policing is set to last a week and follows last weekend's reported assault of a former staff of the Department of Government Efficiency. Trump used that incident to renew his call to put the city under federal control. Trump has long criticized D.C. as being a haven for crime. But violent crime in the district is down 26% this year, and in 2024 reached a 30-year low.
In other news today, in Texas, state Democrats continue their boycott of the state house in order to avoid confirming a new gerrymandered map, which would give Republicans five national House seats. Texas Governor Abbott once again doubled down on his threats of arrest and vowed to continuously call sessions of the House until the Democrats return. Moving to national news, President Trump is calling for a mid-decade census. The next census is expected for 2030. The president